Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome About Guitar. Discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies, where we take a good look at everything guitar, and sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important, so we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. I'm very honored to have a bunch of great people here tonight, but mainly my guest is Tim Pierce, who's been on before, but we were talking a little bit this last weekend, and the show evolved into a whole thing that I think is really exciting because it shows the evolution of a musician in changing times and how he's adapted. And we'll get to that in a minute. But I also want to welcome again back Andrew Sinowick. They're going to be playing together. And the card is right there. It's on May 1st at the Baked Potato, right?
Wednesday night.
you got to get close. He's shy.
This Wednesday.
There you go. And also Craig Malone, thank you for putting this together.
Thanks, Jeff.
It's good to see you. Anyway, before I get into what Tim's doing, I want to play a clip. I'm going to ask you, which one do you think I should play? You've heard the clips that I pulled, Albuquerque Blues, Triad Days, or Already Taken.
Let's do Albuquerque Blues.
Okay.
Since I wrote it for Tim.
Oh, there you go. Okay, so this is both of them playing, and if I'm correct, Tim, according to the album, I'm going to show you the album right now, Second Story, and he's on the left channel when you're... Now, Facebook Live is mono, but if you're listening to this as the radio broadcast, you'll hear it in stereo. So here's Albuquerque Blues. Let me play this first. Now, if I remember, that last lead is you, right? Taking us out. Awesome. Awesome
Thanks.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Now, real quick question about that, and then we'll get into the rest of the show. Did you guys play together live when you were playing? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's you guys interacting directly.
Yeah, he recorded the record live, and the songs I was on, I did live with him. Yeah, it was do or die right there in the moment.
How did you like that?
I would have liked to have taken 10 or 11 or 14 shots at it, but I was happy with my solo.
And the reason I'm asking that question is because the last time you were here, I remember at the time you were primarily doing a lot of session work, and you had mentioned to me that this was the first year at that time that you weren't using cartridge full time, that you were doing all of it at your studio.
That's right.
And I want to shout out to Rick Beato. And he has a YouTube, Tim Pierce, Confessions of a Session Guitar and YouTuber. And I looked at it. You had recommended I take a listen and look at the thing. And it explains his whole studio setup. And I don't think I could do it any better justice than what he did. That's a great video. It explains all his stuff, how he has it wired, what he's doing in the room. So I thought that was very cool, but yeah. I'm not going to touch it.
We can jump off and go further.
So. Yeah. So, but anyway, the thing is that at that time, so you were doing a lot of sessions via Skype and I think the Pro Tools sharing system, whatever it's called. And but let's talk now what's happened, because you've gone into another aspect of your career that's quite successful. And I want you to just kind of give us a little bit of the background, how you got there.
10 years ago, Greg Bissonette and I were talking, and he turned me on to Mike's lessons. Mike is the drum teacher that's the big drum teacher in worldwide with video lessons. Mm-hmm. And then I had another friend who turned me on to Marty Schwartz. And Marty and his partner had a seven-figure business with video content. And I thought if I could do like maybe 10% of that, I'd be a very happy man. And I'm talking about the next thing because, you know, I've been doing sessions for 35 years. So I 10 years ago, a light bulb went off, and I thought, this is what I do next. And I monetized 3 years ago. You know, I spent a few years trying to get in front of a camera and not be an idiot in front of a camera. And you get better at it. You know, just keep doing it. But it's all video. It's a product that I sell to customers. I have one full-time employee, a film editor, two part-time film editors, and a webmaster and a tabs person, mm-hmm. a great tabs guy in Italy who's a friend of mine. We do that remotely. And my time has been split between the two professions for a long time now. I generally try and do short sessions, and then when a session is, and I can do that at my house. You know, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. Like Andrew now, he does a lot of work at home. I'll generally try and design the hours so that I get done with enough time to work on the web business after, you know, I do a session.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to work out. Being at home is very convenient for that.
No, it's interesting. So you have this, you have what I saw on the website, you have the master class, mm-hmm. then you have a various video series of video tutorials.
It's simpler than that. The master class is basically the paid part of it. And then the YouTube channel is the free part of it. That's really that simple. Yeah, the masterclass is what you pay for yearly or monthly. And it's over 100 hours of lessons and content at this point. I keep adding to it.
Mm-hmm. Now, the YouTube channel is the video tutorials. Is that the YouTube?
No, they're one and the same. It's just the video. The YouTube part of it is the free.
Okay.
The free offer, and the masterclass is the paid offer.
So you're besides theory, composition, phrasing. You talk about tone, amps, technique. I mean,
absolutely. Psychology. I mean, everything from what to do when you're scared, you know, at a gig to featuring Carl Verheyen playing stuff that I can't even play to tones to building pedal boards to, I mean, everything under the sun. Even like I'll take a camera into a studio and with the blessing of the artist, I'll put, you know, a real session on it. It's really the entire life of a guitar player. And then a lot of lessons, too. A lot of very simple, mm-hmm. you know, they're blues lessons and melodic soloing lessons and R&B rhythm lessons. So mm-hmm. It's just everything.
Well, I'm going to play a clip. This is from Guitarland, which now this is an older album, if I'm
it
correct.
It is. We don't have to say how old it is.
Okay. Well, it's to me, I think it's kind of... To be honest with you, I think it's kind of hip because there's a couple of things that I noticed on listening to this album is just the different sounds and tones.
Right.
And plus, you're using a lot of guitars. You're layering a lot of guitars, but the way you arrange them and orchestrate them, to me, that's important because it doesn't get in the way. You can hear everything. It's pretty clear what you're doing, but it's a lot of stuff, which I'm sure on a regular record date for somebody else, you probably never got to do that.
Most of the time, no. Yeah.
I mean, because it's kind of cool what you're doing with the, I know you were talking with Rick and you're in the other video using a lot of reverb and delay, and you get this like drone, this beautiful, like lushness. And then with the volume pedal, it just gives you like, it's like a pad. It's really cool. Yeah. So let me play this. This is, I Made It So from Guitar Land. And just listen to what he's, there's just all these different tones that you hear that he's doing all these different, we'll talk a little bit about some of the guitars, what you were using on there, of course, because we're gearheads here. But this is I Made It So. There's so much tone in what I call ear candy.
Thank you.
There's just a lot of ear candy in that piece. Well, let me ask you this. This was when you recorded this, you went to a regular, this was before you had your big home setup, right?
It's kind of an interesting story to me anyway, so I'll only because this and two other songs, this song was cut on analog, and then I got my advance from my little record deal. And I bought ADATs. I did the rest of the record on ADATs. But that was on an analog 24-track tape machine. And I can hear it. You know, I can hear that warmth from...
Where did you do it?
It was actually at a... Okay, the drums... Thank you, Andrew. The drums were done at Kevin Gilbert's studio. And Kevin Gilbert did the keyboards on that song, which are... The keyboards are breathtaking. If you go, when you hear the bridge, it's just beautiful what he did. But it was Brian McLeod at Kevin Gilbert's studio, which, as you know, is now Joe Barisi's. So it's Joe Barisi's tracking room. It was awesome. And then I did the actual guitars at my friend Mark Spiro's house. And then at another place in Studio City that's not there anymore. So we kind of moved around wherever we could get an analog tape machine. Mark Spiro wrote that song with me, and... The idea was to take songs that I had written with songwriters that had lyrics and melodies and just adapt them to guitar. You know, that's why it's kind of a simple melody. There's actually words and lyrics to that song.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
But the acoustic guitars were done at Kevin's?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because they're just beautiful. I was wondering, were they pulling the mics back or were they close?
I think they were close.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. Yeah,
because they sound really full.
Okay, there was a guy named Walter Klissen, a Belgian guy, who actually mixed it, and that's probably partly what you're hearing. He actually was really adept at the EQ and the reverbs and stuff like that.
Do you remember what you were using?
Guitar-wise, it was probably my Larrivé that I've had forever. Still have it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Tom Anderson Strat. And the thing I really do, it was a matchless HC30 that I bought from Mark Sampson. And it's a bit knofflery, that tone, mm-hmm. but I'm not, you know, I don't regret it. I actually, you know.
Oh, it's a great sound.
Yeah.
And then was that was the same thing that you use when you go into the overdrive lead?
Yeah.
That's a beautiful sound.
Yeah. I probably just turned up the volume knob for that.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And it's just straight through.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just pure. The tone is just great.
Thank but you
I mean,
so
I
much.
Love those little guitar riffs going on in the background. And they're in this one, definitely listen to the audio so you can hear it in stereo, because he does a lot of stuff that's going back and forth. And there's interesting the way he doubles the guitars and stuff.
Yeah.
The acoustic is double, if I'm correct.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hard left and right. Do that all the time. Yeah.
And did you just kind of cut it like one track at a time?
Yeah.
As you could fit it in.
And that was just for convenience,
right.
basically, you know. And in fact, we did the drums last, which was kind of disconcerting, because I had really great drum programming. You get attached to it, and then you hear a real drummer, and it takes a couple of weeks, actually, to let go of your preconception about the... And Brian McLeod is a wonderful, amazing drummer, so it benefited a lot from it. But
it's easy to lock into with that
it
track.
Really is. And,
and who played bass on it?
Yeah, on that one, let me think. There were two bass players, Kevin Wyatt, and who was the other bass player? That might have been Kevin Wyatt, yeah. Guys from another lifetime.
Right.
All right, well, I'm gonna play another clip, and what I want everybody to listen to is all the tones. This is another one. This is Guitar Land. I think it's the beginning of the clip, and everything just keeps changing. You just keep going to another guitar, to another guitar, to another guitar, and it's a good example. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about that and your program. So let me play this for you. This is Guitar Land, the title piece of the album. So. So, like, I'm hearing this really cool thing, and then there's another cool thing, and then there's another cool thing.
Yeah.
There's some really interesting things, and again, there's a lot going on in those choruses, per se.
Yeah.
You have a lot of other guitars in here. So I'm going to try to break it down a little bit here.
Okay.
So you had the acoustic, which I assume is the Larrivée, right?
I think it was called a Fylde, that one, F-Y-L-D-E. A guy named Steve Sykes sold me that guitar, and I eventually gave it back to him. Have you ever worked with Steve, Andrew?
Yeah, you told me that story. It's a beautiful story.
Yeah, I bought it from Steve when he needed money, and I gave it. I was working with his wife at Casey Porter's studio, and I said, here, just give this back to him. It was about 20 years later. And
it's a great sounding guitar.
Yeah, British. It's a Django-shaped guitar.
Oh,
you know?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then the electric guitars, there's several different things.
Yeah,
going
I think
on
that's
there.
If it was a Strat back then, it was an Anderson. That's really kind of the only Strat I used back then. And And I can tell it's a Strat because I do kind of use the bar.
Okay.
It's fashionable to use the bar.
And then that real, that processed guitar, was that flange? What were you using?
I think that I had Dave Friedman actually rack mounted a Boss CE1 Chorus for me. And I think that's what that was.
Okay. And that was the Strat through there?
Yeah.
You would be.
Yeah.
And then what about the blowout sound?
Yeah. That was probably a Les Paul.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a great sound. And
then thank you.
What amps? That's the other thing I forgot to ask.
Well, we covered the other one, but on this one, I was actually using a Rivera. I had a great Rivera. I forget what it was called. But so I had the Matchless HC30. I had a Rivera. Mm-hmm. I had a 50-watt Marshall. I had some Voxes. Always on the hunt for the Holy Grail Vox. Never quite found it. Yeah, so that might have been the Rivera.
And the chorus, too, was there a 12-string in there?
You'd have to play it for me again. I don't think so. I think what you're probably hearing is a couple of clean electrics just doubled, and they're naturally chorusing, which is, you know, what's great about doubling anything is you get that slight out-of-tune effect.
Mm-hmm. Now,
you should try it someday, Andrew.
pro tip.
Now the amps were Mike, was it just a single mic thing or did you pull them back? Did they use the room?
No, for me, see that song I had moved into my townhouse in Studio City, and in the garage of my townhouse I had an Anvil case with a 112 and a 57 in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically kind of the silent speaker thing people use today. Only I made it my own and I did it with an Anvil case. So that's literally a 112 with a 57 close mic'd in.
Oh wow!
In a sequester.
Was that a Celestion?
Yeah, always. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So you use Celestion? You're,
yeah.
Okay. No, it's a beautiful sound.
Thank
it's
you.
Really clear. Now, what I was going to ask you was, there's a couple of things that's going on in terms of, first of all, the tones, and mm-hmm. We just talked a little bit about the amps and how you got those sounds, but also too, it's just. The orchestration of that. So what I'm asking is how would you present that in your class, so to speak? I mean,
I have actual episodes that are based on, you know, layering guitar parts. And in that particular situation, the verse is a pair of doubled acoustics. And you really have to muscle when you're playing that kind of acoustic guitar. It's kind of unnatural in a way because you're doing the palm muting a little bit. Can I get this thing going? Oh, there we go. That kind of thing. And on mm-hmm. an acoustic, you kind of have to bear down on it. But that's doubled. And then the verse part, I mean, you really don't want to overdo things. But at certain points in the song, you do want to overdo things. My goal with any song that I work on is to make the chorus blossom. And so I'll take like three elements in the verse. And then when the chorus comes, I do everything I can to make it open like... It's some glorious thing if I can. And so I might have a pair of cleans in three different frequencies. But everything's hard left and right. I actually don't like panning that's not hard left and right. I see people do that kind of 30. I mean, how do you feel about panning, Andrew?
I don't know. There's no rules, right? I mean,
for me, there are. I'm old school. I like just left and right and center, personally. So
wait, you mean I should be panning things?
Your studio's mono, right?
Yeah. Old school.
Old school. That's really old school. That's funny. No, like for example, one of the things what you were showing in Rick's video is the layering, how you spread out the echoes, use multiple echoes, and then you have the reverbs, and it's just amazingly huge.
Well, thank you. Yeah, there's no real secret to it other than experimentation and. Like I said, it's you want to have certain sections be small, and then usually the chorus be really, really big and full. I kind of adhere to that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's frequencies. It's like you can have low guitars and mid-frequency guitars and high guitars, and then whatever you put in the same. As long as you pan those all hard left and right, you get this kind of wall of mm-hmm. orchestration, and then you put the main guitar at the center in a situation like this.
Now, when you're setting up the guitars and recording them, are you consciously like EQing them so they're in their specific pocket, or do you just record them flat and then have that done in the mix down?
Everything's flat. And lately, you know, I spent about 20 years giving mix engineers too much bottom end, because when you're actually performing the guitar part, you want it to be super fat, but mix engineers always kind of scoop that out. So lately I've actually been turning the bass knob down on my amps and kind of getting, doing smaller sounds. You kind of don't need a lot of bass when you're recording a lot of the time, and it just, it makes more room for other parts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But also I tend towards cleaner parts now, because you can actually put more. What'll happen is I'll layer maybe 5 or 6 or 8 parts, and then I'll realize that a couple of those parts are too distorted, and I'll go back and redo those clean, and it's always better.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you do a distorted line, or you're doing something, do you double it with a clean one, then you can mix the two so you get the articulation and still the fatness?
Not really. Although there were records I did in the 90s where that was, you know, there was a science to that, where you would make the left and right just slightly different with a different guitar. Or even if you took a Gibson and a Fender, you would get a really nice tempering thing because the neck, yeah, the different necks on both the guitars.
But when you're working by yourself and you go, okay, here's a rhythm part, now let me double it. Do you traditionally, the double is exactly the same?
I guess I kind of do. And it may be out of laziness at this point, but...
Because I read and I hear people go, oh, something's got to be different. It can't be the same. If it's the same, there's no point. But whenever I try that, I feel like it's always actually better if it's the same, because then those, you know, minute differences, that's actually what's making it sound fuller. And I feel like you notice that kind of thing more.
That means I don't have to go back and redo all those guitars from the last, if you feel the same way.
Yeah.
I don't have to go, uh-oh. Yeah, I guess I feel the same way. It's instinctive for me. Because here's the thing. You actually want to have the illusion of one giant guitar.
Yeah.
And whatever it takes to create the illusion of one giant guitar, even if it's 10 guitars, it's kind of what you go after, I guess.
Yeah. What I found in mixing, when you doubled guitars, if you panned them left, hard left and hard right, you didn't have to bring them up as much in the mix. They just fit.
That's totally true. Yeah,
You just have one guitar, you got to turn it up louder.
Absolutely.
Which starts interfering with the rest of it.
Yeah.
But you don't. You just use the same guitar, and you too, or do you? I usually would take a different acoustic and just double with a different one.
I spent years doing records with great engineers and major like producers who would do. You would take all the time in the world and audition the next guitar and figure it out really painstakingly, and I don't do any of that anymore. It's just, you know, I create a stereo sound.
I don't think you need it.
No, you don't.
It sounds good, but I mean, I get the reason behind it. But
I think also, too, you know, if it's a huge track, meaning you need to, there's going to be a ton of elements, I think that's when, just keep it the same, because that's what's going to allow it to poke through. If there's less happening, then I think there's maybe room to really notice the differences.
Right. Yeah, if it was just two guitars, bass and drums,
then you
would take a different approach.
It's like a two-guitar band.
Exactly. Yeah. And then it's two guys. You picture the two guys on the stage, and they're different, and they have different sounds, and there's nothing more magical than that. So but that's another concept. Like if I'm doing the verse of a song and it has two guitars, I'll try and be the two different guitar players, and I'll use a Tele and a Les Paul, and I'll make sure the parts are not the same.
Right.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, that's the opposite, you know.
Now, when you two guys were playing together on Albuquerque, what were you using?
I used my Les Paul for the whole record because I didn't want to be worried about, like, well, what I'd play on this song, and then, well, what's Tim going to play? So I just kind of went, I'm just going to use my Les Paul. And then you used...
I used a PRS because we had done the gig already.
Right.
So that kind of cemented in the sound of the band, and... I have a lot of guitars. I have a lot of Les Pauls. I love them, but I have trouble staying in tune on a Gibson. And because with the record was done live, I stuck with the PRS, and it sounded great to me. I used my Naylor Superdrive 60 head and my pedals for distortion, the Nashville kind of ODR1, mm-hmm, you know, pedal.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually that night I did not have enough gain. It's funny. I brought in a small pedal board, and Sean Hurley loaned me a random pedal. That's the fun thing. I remember the first time I saw Steve Lukather work, he had just gotten this little Japanese distortion pedal, And he was trying it for the first time, and of course it sounded amazing. You know, it was like, oh, just random. And it was like, how is it that you can just plug this little $30 pedal in and sound amazing? But that's really, you know, every day is the first day of school, and you can borrow a pedal from somebody and plug it in, and in that moment, it's just like, wow, that's
yeah.
the sound.
No, that's cool. That's really, last week we had Guitar Shorty, and he was telling us that he loaned Hendrix his wah-wah. And the rest is history.
Wow.
But anyway, what I wanted to ask you also, too, is when another approach of layering guitars, like you said, where you make it into one big guy. So do you sometimes, like if you're using two acoustic guitars, rather than pan them left and right, do you have one guitar play something? You simplify the parts, but they complement each other, so it sounds like this huge guitar.
Oh yeah, I think I'm talking about something slightly different. It's like if the layman, the listener who's a layperson, listens to what you're doing and just assumes that it's a big jangly guitar, but really you've put, you know, maybe six or eight layers in. So you're talking about the same thing I am, but it doesn't really have to do with panning. It just has to do with probably a lot of simple orchestrating, basically a lot of
right.
simplicity in different frequencies. And just making it sound like, you know, it's, you know, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever.
Because I noticed in one of your signature things that you do is you do these very interesting arpeggios. And you'll do this and you'll double them.
That's true, yeah.
And you do, yeah. And it's yeah. a, it's kind of a signature.
It is,
but
yeah.
What's interesting is that, like, for example, the only way I can ask this question is from something that happened with me where I did something where I used two guitars. I had a six string playing a very basic lower end thing, boom, 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 boom.
Yep, yep.
And then the 12 string was tinkling on the top, but it blended together into one like huge guitar.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm talking about. So if here's the guitar. When I moved to L.A., all the eighth note guitar parts were down here, right? And then Coldplay came along, and all the eighth note guitar parts moved up here. You can still use that stuff. The arpeggio you're talking about is often an upbeat. But you combine that with... And then, what else? They're all really simple things, but they're all in different frequencies, and you can create, you can instantly come up with a little guitar orchestra, and that's really, and by panning, you can get stuff out of the way of each other, and what you're talking about, if you pan hard left and right, the volume can go way down, and it becomes almost like a subliminal, you know, thing. It becomes like a pad.
Yeah,
and then you add delays, and
it just yeah. goes into that pocket,
yeah.
and you don't have to. It's I've experienced a mix where you basically it just mixes itself once you get it set.
Yeah.
It just goes.
Now, since Andrew's here, how do you do it?
Wow, I mean, I don't know. Do what? You know, it's kind of different every time.
But
I mean,
you told me
ways.
that we talked about the Coldplay part, and you told me you try to resist that.
Oh,
because
no,
it's
yeah.
it's.
Well, I said it's funny. I heard the Joshua Tree, you know, something from that record on the radio today. I love that record, and
yeah, me too.
I mean, it hit me right at that age where you're like,
yeah.
I don't know, it just
yeah.
gets inside you,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
So I want to put an edge part on. Every chorus,
right?
And people love it.
Yeah.
So it
yeah.
tends to work, and
yeah.
it's exciting, and like
yeah.
you said, it really makes the chorus kind
yeah.
of explode.
Yeah.
But then I sort of felt like, man, am I doing the same thing like on every song? So now I sort of try. It's weird because at the end of the day, you want the person to be happy, but yet I want to feel like I'm being creative and unique and. You know,
well, how do you approach your album? Well, this album was like a in terms with you guys playing two guitars, what keyboards, bass, and drums. Mm-hmm. But how do you approach? Have you done things where you've done more elaborate layering and stuff, or whether it's in a session or your own stuff? How do you approach that?
Similar to what we've been talking about.
I've heard him do what I do. So that's the thing. I put him on the spot right there. But Andrew, I've heard you do the same kind of thing I do. He does that. But this record.
But yeah, we're talking about kind of two completely different things.
This record, he's the artist. He's a guitar artist. So it's more about just your solo voice as a guitar player, right?
Right. Yeah.
And isn't part of it also, too, that you've designed this album so that it's made to be played live? It's not an elaborate studio album with all these trick effects and.
It's funny because I remember, you know, being in school and stuff like that and getting solo records by my heroes, and most of them, I always kind of wanted to hear what Tim did, like, oh man, I want to hear all this lush, crazy, a million guitar overdub, but a lot of them are not that way, and it used to bug me, like, come on, I want to hear, you know.
Yeah.
And then, of course, what do? I do exactly what I didn't want to hear.
Well, you're doing the right thing. If you're trying to be a guitar artist, you kind of have to. It's a more minimal approach. I got away with something doing all that was my guitar artist record, but I got away with something. And the guy who signed me, I delivered some stuff where he said, you know, it's too unfocused. You have to have one voice going on. So,
well, what I was going to say is. In a way, if this is going to be an outlet, then I'm not going to do what we do all day long. I'm going to do something different. Yeah.
But now, did you ever tour with that album?
I did two local gigs and a couple of like record store gigs. Not really.
And how did you do that?
I put a band together for the two local gigs. I played at the Baked Potato in Pasadena and also played at the Mint. And they were really, really fun gigs. It was just another guitar player, a bass player, and a drummer, and myself. Was really
so
fun.
you it was a lot more stripped down from what the record was, right?
Absolutely. And it was a challenge.
That's interesting to bring it down. And then and you got to think about that too. You're this album, you can play it live, and it worked.
And part of the other thing was the way that we did this in 6 hours, it sort of made it like, okay, I have a finite amount of time to get this thing done. And had I taken the other approach, and I might one day, because I love doing that, you know, it's like if I'm doing that at home, if it's a guitar layers thing, there's just an infinite amount of time you can spend, like, well, let me go back and try it with this guitar, you know. And I could just see myself just never getting it across the finish line.
He asked me to do one of my songs in the set at the Baked Potato. I chose one, and I remember in that song, in the solo, I overdubbed like crazy. I mean, I did that. I sat in my pajamas and just got it where I wanted it. There was a squeak that I loved so much in the solo that I redid everything except this little squeak that was in this one spot. Shouldn't be admitting that, but it is the opposite. I kept doing it till I was satisfied.
Now, let me ask you this for doing this live gig on May 1st, by the way, at the Baked Potato. I'm going to plug that again. What are you guys going to use? What's your setup? We'll start with you, and I want to know what both you guys are going to use for this gig.
A pair of Bogner 112s that are ported, that are amazing. That's the greatest 112. And then I'll use my Naylor Superdrive 60. I'll have a spare one sitting behind it in case something goes wrong, which it shouldn't, but you never know.
So you're using one amp with two speakers.
Yeah, one amp, two speakers, and I'll have my big pedal board this time with my kind of Nashville distortion pedals, the Mohs Distortion and the Nobles ODR1, and then my trusty Line 6 Echo Park delay, a couple of fancy H9 Eventide delays, some reverbs, a tremolo.
And that's all going to go mono. You're not going to use a stereo.
Mono, right? And it's actually great because he's stereo, and the thing for me to do in this situation is be very different.
Okay.
And it worked great. The first gig we did, it was kind of perfect. And I don't say that word very often, but it really was kind of, except that I was too loud. I'm going to try and not play as loud this time.
So
I'm going to use two full Marshall stacks.
Yeah.
But I am going to play in stereo because
that's good.
I'm kind of a delay freak.
That's great.
It,
just, yeah,
it sounds so good when you get kind of two different delay times.
So,
left and right.
Are you? What are you going to use? Are you going to use Marshall? Little Marshall?
No. I have a pair of Rivera amps that I really like.
Okay.
And they're just clean, but they just sound really great. And the mid range is such that you can dial in just the right frequency, kind of for the stage and the band, and they sound good at any volume level, which is not something I find on a lot of amplifiers.
And you'll be using your Paul?
Yeah, same.
And you'll be using, I presume, this guitar.
Yeah, my fancy new PRS.
Yes. That's a great guitar. We should. I mean, I can't ignore that guitar. You got to tell us a little bit about this guitar.
Okay, so I went to the PRS Experience Festival, which is their factory is amazing. They're doing really well. It was last July. And I did a seminar there, and I said, don't pay me for the seminar, just build me a guitar. And they said, okay, so I chose the wood from his private, you know, he's got the private room of wood. And then when I actually started to ask about all the, you know, extras, I kind of ordered everything. It's kind of like overdone. And I didn't expect it to sound good, and it really, really sounds good. So
it's a curved back, curved top.
Yeah.
Is there a solid block down the middle, like a 335, or is it all hollow?
Yes, there is. I can see it. It's solid.
Okay, so it's like a 335 type.
Oh, no, look, it's only solid here at the back. Then it's open. I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. It's kind of a semi-335 type of thing.
Yeah.
Look at that wood. This is beautiful. Flame maple.
And they do a neat thing. He, you know, signs it on the back and custom-made for Tim Pierce. It's really a nice thing. He's a great guy. He's
great guitars. What's the fifth knob for?
You know, I've struggled with that because when I asked for the piezo, I had no idea that it would mean there'd be a fifth knob. And I got the guitar and I was thinking, there's no way I can get rid of that knob. There is no way. There's a hole in the flame maple under that knob.
You could put another switch in there. You could put the producer switch.
I thought of that, but then you'll have a switch. I mean, at least these knobs look like little jewels or something, you know? It's like I've gotten used to it. I wish they hadn't done it, but
especially if you use any type of vibrato, there's no. Well, you might be able to put a B5 on there.
No, it's fine the way it is. It's.
So you have the piezo pickups and the bridge. So,
which is I just asked for everything they make, and so it came with a fifth knob.
Which is kind of cool. It kind of does. You can kind of do live what you do on the studio, where you have a clean track and a dirty track.
You're right. That's actually I hadn't thought of that. So. Yeah, I'll try that on Wednesday night and
send
maybe
it to
it'll
the
work.
PA.
That's what I'm going to do. Yeah. I'll put it through the PA.
And they'll go, the acoustic guitar is just way too loud.
Try something new at the gig.
Perfect.
No, I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, when I first moved here, I went to a Robin Ford gig at the Ford Theater. And Michael Landau was playing rhythm guitar for him. And so I thought, wow, that's a good tradition. So I'm gonna play behind Andrew at the Baked Potato.
There you go.
Awesome, yeah.
No, I think this is going to be amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. And just so people want to know that if they're curious, Guitarland is available to be, you can.
Oh, now, it's on Spotify and iTunes. It's everywhere. Yeah.
It's everywhere.
Yeah,
so you can, yeah. I don't think the CD is around anymore.
No.
Okay, it's all digital.
Yeah.
And the website is timpierceguitar.com.
Yeah, or my name. All roads lead to the right place. And you just click on Masterclass, and if you're interested in the lessons, there's a 14-day free trial, so you can decide if you love it or hate it before you buy in.
And then you're just Tim Pierce Guitar for the YouTube channel?
Yeah. Yeah. Once again, very easy to find.
Now, Andy, do you have a YouTube channel?
I do. I have a couple of followers, even. I think it's just my name, yeah.
Anderson,
I'm not super active in the YouTube world like Tim is, but, you know.
And then your website?
Just my full name, andrewsinowick.com. And if you get close, if you type it into Google, Google will...
It's Googleable.
It.
Yeah. No, he's well known. You're not unknown on Google. You are well known.
Uh-oh.
So anyway, the albums that I was playing, Guitarland is Tim's, and this is Second Story, where they're playing together, And this is a great album. Both of them are just, I recommend it. If you want to hear tone and just how the art of layering multi-guitars, Tim's album is a classic example. And it's a good textbook for me. It's a textbook on how to layer guitars and do intricate parts. This album, it's two guitars, keyboards, bass, and drums. A little simpler. I'm curious when you do that multi-dub, I want to see what you do there. But there's some really great things that he's doing, and the technique and tone that he's getting on this record. We had gone through this. If you go back to, I think it was about a month or so ago, when you were on my show, we went in detail on this album, and it's a killer album. I can't stress enough to
available May 3rd.
Oh, it's not out yet.
It is not. You are super duper.
I've been telling everybody go get it right now, and they're like, "What the hell?"
That's good though.
You can pre-order it.
So it's scarcity.
It's available May 3rd.
May 3rd,
or so at the show,
you'll have it at the show. Yeah. So
May 1st at the Baked Potato this Wednesday.
Yes, and it's at is it one show or two shows?
Two shows
at
the Baked Potato. Yeah,
times.
9:30 and 11:30.
So
I don't know who's going to play the 11:30 set, because Tim and I are both get up early. But we'll have somebody there in our place.
And although they do get up early on the website, I noticed it says 9:30 a.m. So we will not be performing.
That's much better.
Live. Oh, that would make Andrew knows that would make me very happy.
So we will not be performing 9:30 a.m.
So the first show is them, and then subs are coming in for the. So, it's the Andrew Senowick substitute band.
Yeah. The alternate. Definitely in the PM.
Yeah, it's pretty no soon. Confusion. There's going to be three different Andrew Senowick bands touring.
Yeah.
So it's totally three different groups. It's coming. But anyway, yes, check out their websites. And Tim, I think this is cool what you're doing with the web, the master classes
Thank
and
you.
Stuff. And keep us posted what you're doing and what's going on there. I'm going to take us out with a clip. This is called Woman Be True, and this is another thing where there's just all sorts of interesting tones and stuff that you do. Do you remember? Do you have anything to set this up, or do you remember what you're using?
I'd have to hear. I could. Is if this is the last thing everybody's going to hear?
Yeah, I'll leave your mic on if you want to say what you're doing, okay, but yeah. I'll play this. Everybody, Craig, thank you so much. Andy, it's always good to see you. And Tim, thank you so much. But anyway, this is Woman Be True. Everybody have a great week. We'll see you next week. But I'm going to leave the mic on so he can comment.
Anderson Strat. Trying to think what kind of overdrive that would have been. It was probably just the lead channel on the Rivera amp I was using. No, you know what? It was a Marshall. It was a 100-watt Marshall. I couldn't believe I actually used it on this ballad.